Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
A word of warning. This podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes some strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing.
Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast covering high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. I'm your host, Anna Garcia. Our cases this week. A 25-year-old college student goes on vacation with her friends to Mexico, and she dies. At first, the friends say, oh, she must have drunk too much. But the autopsy looks like it was closer to homicide. Now a video has surfaced, which looks like the young woman was getting a beating from another woman with others in the party looking on. The FBI is now investigating and an arrest warrant has been issued. But first, an alleged catfishing killer has met his end in an exchange of police gunfire. Authorities say the suspect, a newly hired sheriff's deputy, stalked his 15-year-old victim online using a fake profile. He then drove across the country to kidnap the girl. Investigators say that before grabbing the teen, this man killed the girl's mother and her grandparents, and then he set their home on fire. The 15-year-old is the lone survivor in this crime. We are recording this on Wednesday, November 30th of 2022. Our guest today is Mike King, a criminal investigator with nearly 30 years of law enforcement experience, a published author, an expert in profiling and violent crimes, the creator and host of the podcast Profiling Evil. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you, Anna. I'm so honored you would invite me back.
Oh, we've got to tell everyone how you ended up here. First of all, Mike is in Australia right now in Sydney. Yesterday, our guest was called to court because so many of our great experts are very busy. And I texted you, Mike, and you were on an airplane and you said to me, I'm 5 hours from Sydney.
Oh, man. And I'll tell you, that is a brutal flight.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for making time for us. We know you have a meeting. It's early morning there. You have a meeting you've got to get to with authorities. So we're going to get right to our cases. We're so grateful you're with us, Mike.
Well, this is an amazing case. In fact, all of these cases today, I was just so excited to be a part of it. Thank you.
All right, let's get right to it. Our first case is out of Riverside, California, where police are trying to figure out what would motivate a young cop to kill a family of three and then grab their 15-year-old teen. None of this makes sense. Police say this is a case of catfishing. Basically, the alleged killer had made a profile online. It's not that he sold. He's 28, but of course, she's 15 and a minor. He made a profile online. Presumably, there's not a lot out there that he would have appeared to have been much younger than he is, age appropriate for the 15-year-old. Generally, with these catfishing cases, the person who makes the fake profile makes themselves look, you know, gorgeous, not to reflect their real life. And they developed a relationship online. And then the man decides to get in his car and drive from Virginia to Southern California. This is insane, Mike.
You know, this one from the very get-go, I had these like flashbacks of the Delphi case and just the things that were going on there with the catfishing. But here you got a guy who has a career. He has things going for him. But you know what? This is one of those cases where you really look at the different personas in a person's life. This public persona where he's putting across this protector view of I'm out there, but as a police officer protecting. And I'll tell you, nothing makes good cops angrier than bad cops, Anna. But you got that public persona. Then you got this private side that we all have that, you know, kind of comes out at home and our companions see our ornery side. But the secret side is where this case comes together and we start seeing what this predator thinks about, what he focuses on, what his preferential victims are. And I'm going to be really surprised if there are more than one in this case.
And what is shocking and very disturbing and unsettling to the rest of us is because he is a young cop, and we'll get into the fact that he had been hired as a Virginia State Trooper, made it through the academy, worked for a little while, not too long, and then had just gotten this job at the sheriff's department, which means, Mike, was this guy not checked for mental competency?
You know, I was thinking of that back, you know, 50 years ago when I started in law enforcement, and we didn't really have background checks, but today they have psychological checks that at least try to give them the best chance to say, hey, there's a red flag here. But I'm wondering if we're going to learn that there were red flags along the way. Why does this guy quit his job after such a short period of time and go to a sheriff's office? Was it because he was able to be a little more under the radar? You know, these psychopathic personalities oftentimes are really good, likable people that you meet in the bar. But when you start to get to know them as a human being, you start seeing all the ugliness.
Well, let's talk about the ugliest man currently, 28-year-old Austin Edwards, a cop himself accused of this massacre, but he is dead too. He was killed in a gun battle with police in the desert as they tried to rescue the teen that he had kidnapped. Now, once Austin Edwards got the girl's address, and we're not naming her, she's a minor, she's a victim here, a survivor. Once he got the girl's address, then he drove 2,500 miles from North Chesterfield, Virginia, to the teen's home in Riverside, California. Police say that on Black Friday, how symbolic is that? November 25th, he gets to the area and he starts staking out the family's house. He then killed the girl's mother, Brooke Winnick, who's 38, and then the grandparents, Mark Winnick, 69, and Sherry Winnick, 65. Then he sets the house on fire. I don't understand why he needs to set the house on fire. And then he kidnaps the girl. We do not know yet the manner of death. Police have not released how they were killed. I'm sure that there's a reason for this, and I know that there's an investigation, because even though the man who is suspected of committing this crime is dead, they have to figure out what happened here, how it happened, who failed in the system, and are there any other victims out there, right?
Yeah, I mean, this one goes back to, I think, basic investigative experiences that the officers are going to have as they look at this case from a behavioral standpoint. And that's something I was trained by profilers to do, is look at the behavior and see if it matches up with the physical and the forensic evidence and other kinds of things. And so we start thinking about this fantasy that must be going on in this predator's mind as he's traveling across the country. This is going to be where forensically law enforcement's going to be able to examine what the interactions are, because I guarantee he is texting and tweeting or whatever it is that these catfishers do as he's coming across the country. I'm also interested in finding out as this case unfolds, if there was a conversation of planning this, that we're going to run away together, or I'm going to pick you up and we're going to have a Ferris Bueller day together. And she's just thinking we're going to run to a local theme park and goof off or something, but there's got to be some planning, and that's going to start laying out the groundwork, which I think is going to really drive us to what happened in that house, Anna. And is this something that he planned on going in and killing three people, or all of a sudden his fantasy exploded when mom was home and grandma and grandpa are there at the same time?
Oh, and the part that's so disturbing to me is that the neighbors noticed his car, noticed that he was acting weird. First of all, he parks in a neighbor's driveway. Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. You want to call attention? You park in my driveway? I'm going to be out there in 1 minute with my bullhorn. So.
Yeah. I mean, here you got a cop who probably lives and breathes by Ring cameras and other kinds of things on doorbell ringers and people's home security systems. And he blows it right off the bat.
Right. He's in someone's driveway. The neighbor calls police and says, look, there's someone in my driveway and he's acting weird because apparently he kept getting in and out of the vehicle and walking and pacing and going back and forth maybe to the house. Maybe they weren't home. It's unclear really what was going on there. And police did respond, but not to that call. They responded to the next call when the neighbor said, something horrible is happening. Our teen neighbor is being whisked away into a car. She doesn't have any pants on. She doesn't have any shoes on. And there's, you know, a slightly older man getting her into a car. Apparently the girl tried to say something, but was so distressed. It was unclear. She probably couldn't even speak. She was in such shock after, you know, presumably seeing her parents murdered and her mother and her grandparents. So, you know, ow, and the fire, Mike. The fire was such a distraction that when the police got there to do the welfare check about the call about the girl who was whisked into a car, then they see a fire. So all eyes are on the fire and he gets away with her.
Yeah, I mean, this has got to really point to what, you know, when these guys do this, their fantasies fall apart. And when fantasy falls apart, we go from organized thinking to disorganized thinking. We could see it already starting to unfold, can't we? He probably had somehow in this fantasy, she was going to come out in her prom dress and slip into his car and they were going to run away and be happily ever after, or at least get her away where he could then violate her. But things didn't work out. Her mom says, you're not going anywhere, or she isn't even awake yet. But this pacing back and forth also tells you that his plan was falling apart. And I think we're going to really see this case come together and show us how disorganized it became. This fire, just an attempt to destroy evidence, don't you think, Anna?
Oh, probably. But I also believe that part of the shock, the worst of it being the horrific crime committed against her family, was also her shock of, you're him? You?
Yeah.
And now she's like, oh my gosh, what is happening here?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're not the guy on my mobile device that I've been looking at for 2 months.
You're not that guy. You're not.
What a nightmare.
Oh my gosh, what a nightmare. And so, you know, they head out into the desert and here's the other thing. The guy is driving a red Kia Soul. Is there a car easier to spot anywhere on this planet than a Kia Soul? In fact, whenever I'm on the road working on cases, I always ask, do you have a Kia Soul available? Because I can never remember what car, you know, because when you're on the road and you're like in this city and that, and you don't know what hotel you're staying in, you can't remember what your car is. Give me a Kia Soul. What is he driving, a red Kia Soul?
So this part I haven't been able to figure out. Do we know if it's his vehicle or is it a rental car?
Well, that's right. If you were Anna Garcia at the rental counter, just by instinct, you would say, do you have a Kia Soul? I don't know if it was his or not.
Preferably with a pizza delivery sign on the top so I can remember which car it is. You're right.
What hotel am I at? Which Hampton Inn? Okay. So, you know, I do want to talk about his job, just the little bit that we know. So little has come out. But this is important because this is a guy who's clearly, clearly unstable and dangerous. There's no question about it. So how did he pass all these evaluations? So at the time of this hellfire, Austin Edwards was working for the Washington County Sheriff's Department in Virginia. He was literally hired a few days earlier on November 16th. Okay? Brand new to the job, this guy. Maybe he had, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday off and this was his only window. I don't know. I mean, he literally was just hired. Before this job, he was a trooper with the Virginia State Police. Now, he reportedly graduated from the academy in January 21st of this year, Mike. But 8 months later, on October 28th, he resigned. I don't know what to make of that.
This goes back to they're not sharing his personnel records. They're saying there's legal reasons why. I suspect it's going to come out in testimony during the trial, but there's something that he's not performing well, or it's not allowing him to continue to do the things that he wants to do. Going to a smaller sheriff's office is to provide him a little more anonymity, a little easier lifestyle. I don't know, but I think we're going to see people come out.
I mean, no disrespect at all to all the sheriff's departments who have the most amazing people, but oftentimes, especially in the Northeast, the state troopers are regarded as the top law enforcement agency for those states.
That's right.
They are the premier, like, that's the job. You're a state trooper, you're that much more special. And so the
you're right. Yeah, and oftentimes those sheriff's offices will handle misdemeanor cases, but as soon as they get into something that's a violent crime, it's going to be handed off to the state police to manage. So, it really is a difference in rural policing in some of those areas compared to having the state authorities come in.
So the Virginia State Police say that Edwards underwent psychological testing as well as a thorough background check and a pre-employment polygraph prior to his work at the state police. So that means all of that happened before he even finished the academy. So presumably he passed all of this. How they let this psycho in there is beyond anyone's comprehension. And then the Virginia State Police did make a comment to the Washington Post that Edwards, quote, never exhibited any behaviors to trigger any internal administrative or criminal investigations. I suppose that's possible.
Well, sure. Yeah, he probably never was catfishing during the time he was in the academy. Who knows? But this is the part I kind of keep harping on this fantasy side of these cases. But this is the part where we got to really think about, and it may be that this was the first time that he ever went and found and had physical contact with a victim. But this fantasy process is kind of bizarre. You think about our own fantasies in our own lives. I mean, everyone has them. We think about maybe being a rock star or something else. Well, we replay these fantasies and they're perfect in our minds. But as soon as we start to act them out, they fall apart. But the thing that's so amazing about fantasy and the reason it drives especially serial predators is that it's never as cool as reality. And so they always have to figure out, how am I going to work this out so that I can actually do it? But then when they do it, the victim doesn't cooperate or something else goes wrong and they have to go back and fix it in their mind and start over. So maybe during this period of time after he becomes a police officer, that's when he starts really getting jazzed up on this fantasy side. Works his 8 hours, goes home and spends 16 on the computer.
I almost dread hearing more of the details of what was going on in this sick man's life. Because what his internet search history and all his fake social profiles are going to prove is that he truly, truly was a sick individual. And that's going to be very frightening to a lot of parents. And, you know, here's the other thing. I do appreciate, you know, the police stand there and they all say, you know, we've heard it all week since this happened, because this happened not too far from where I live in Southern California. And every police officer being interviewed, and this is why you have to watch your children so closely on social media. Look, I hear you. I am a mother. But let me tell you, we don't have the weapons to defend ourselves and our children against these insane individuals. It is a war zone out there in social media. And it's like, this isn't the parents' fault. This girl thinks that she's communicating with a guy her own age. We see this all the time. These profiles have so many aspects to them that they look realistic, you know, and isn't just this. I mean, I don't know how we can defend our kids. How can we protect them?
I agree with you. And I'm dealing it now at the level of grandkids that are starting to get mobile devices. The predators out there are going to take advantage of places where they can interact and it disappears in a few hours. They're going to take advantage of every situation they can to put up different imagery of themselves. And I think the only thing we can really do, Anna, is educate our kids that this world is full of predators who are trying to take advantage. It might be just to get your credit card number, or it might be to do something as horrid as this case has shown us.
Yeah, that is really the hard part, because, you know, you'll look at the pictures, and we know there are so many aspects to social media where people always present their best self, you know, maybe not their real self. You're not always in perfect lighting. That's one aspect of, can you really live this kind of life on social media? Then you have the aspect of the people who are pretending to be other people entirely, and then get tricked in. And it's the most dangerous when you're dealing with vulnerable children, with young people. I just, you know, it frightens me. Like I said, it's a war zone out there. It is a war zone. It's guerrilla warfare. And we as parents are hard-pressed.
This sense of needing to belong, especially when you're a teenager, is so compelling that they're willing to step out on thin ice just to have that someone pay attention to them, or that opportunity to meet somebody that's going to really make their heart pitter patter. And it is such a ripe ground for predators that, again, I think that our responsibility is to continue in the schools and at home to teach, be wise, because everything you put out on the internet is going to stay on the internet.
And we as parents, as the parents in my group, my son is older now, not that old, but, you know, we always, the nice thing is, as they're growing up and they're starting to get on social media, they let their parents be part of the account so you can kind of watch. Then all of a sudden, you know, want mom and dad on the account, but maybe you forgot to remove so-and-so's mother. And so we would always be on the phone and I'd say, is your daughter... is your son, or I'd get the call and be like, I just saw, and thank God for this secret network of parents calling each other, watching everyone's child like a hawk.
Well, yeah, and I don't know about you, but I mean, my wife has had to censor me on Facebook. I can only Facebook my family members because I don't know when to shut the throttle down and say, well, I don't agree with that, or I do agree, but we allow personal information to come out in little bits and pieces. And we think, well, it's no big deal that I say I live in Riverside, but maybe a week or two earlier, I said I live at Oak Crest Drive. And all of a sudden these predators start gluing the pieces together and they figure out more about us. And again, it doesn't just mean kids. And for the adults that are listening, it might mean your credit information or anything else. I mean, we just have to be careful.
Absolutely. So back to Friday, November 25th. At around 11:08, Riverside police officers arrive on the street where the family home is. Now, they're looking for that teen girl who was just reported as being, you know, dragged into a car without her pants on. And all of a sudden, they're dealing with this huge fire. Everything gets redirected to the fire. And it isn't until the firefighters get in there that they find the bodies of three people. Now, police are like, oh my, we've got three dead people, and there's a teen girl who was just removed from this home, and the neighbors say that there was a weird guy out here staking the place out. So they finally, 2 hours later, they locate this red Kia that he's driving. So it's about 1:15 now in the afternoon, and we're a county over in San Bernardino, and we're in the desert. They find the car. And they, as part of the pursuit, I guess the car somehow is disabled or pinned or cornered again. There's a lot of information we don't have. The girl manages to run out of the car. So they get the girl, she's safe, and now they're in a gun battle with the guy, and he ends up dying. He's shot in the middle of all this.
Yeah, clearly that 2 hour time period, boy, I'll tell you, law enforcement was going after forensics, probably trying to get metrics on the vehicle to get location, or using his mobile device or her mobile device, because we don't know if they had his by that time. I wonder if she had her mobile device, which is going to be interesting to see how
she
that
didn't
comes
even
out.
Have her
you
pants on.
Well, that's a good point.
You know, this is a girl who was literally ripped out of her home in shock, and it's actually a benefit that it was a red Kia Soul, right? Because they were then able, they knew what they were looking for, the kind of car they were looking for, and that seriously, you know, narrowed it. And thank goodness he didn't change cars, because he could, if he had changed cars and they would have been looking for a red Kia Soul, that would have been the end of her.
Yeah.
So obviously the teen is so traumatized. Police have said that interviewing her and debriefing her has been really challenging. And I guess, you know, at this point, is there really an urgency? You need to calm her down. You need to get her treatment immediately. And, you know, where is she going to go? We don't know all the details of her family. So, you know, but if she lived there with her mom and her grandparents, her family's just been decimated.
Yeah. Could you imagine?
No, really, I can't. I can't. And I feel terrible for her and the family. And, you know, God bless all the neighbors who tried so hard to call the cops and warn them. I don't know if they had gotten there any sooner. Could it have been any better? But maybe if someone was able to respond to the fact that there's a crazy man in my driveway, you know, and then someone would have said, yeah, what are you doing here?
You know, those kind of cases, sadly, those kind of calls just drop to the bottom of the pile. Police departments are understaffed right now. Their calls for service response times have doubled, in some cases tripled. And so, you know, what used to be even a 911 call where you hope they'd get there in 3 minutes is taking longer. Imagine now I've got to push aside a 911 high priority crime of violence somewhere else to go deal with a suspicious circumstance. And those cases fall slowly to the bottom of the rung. This is where it's so important that we remain vigilant, like these people in the neighborhood did, continued to watch and escalated that thing as quick as they did. I wonder if they were providing photos and information to law enforcement as well that helped speed this up. And maybe what a great reminder to all of us that, man, we walk around with these mobile devices. We ought to just take pictures if something's bugging us, because it might be the thing that saves a life.
Our next case is out of Mexico with strong ties to Charlotte, North Carolina. 25-year-old Shanquella Robinson was on vacation with six friends in Cabo. The group had rented a luxury villa on the water, beautiful. Shanquella, who was a student at Winston-Salem State University, was found dead in the unit on October 29th of this year. That was one day after arriving on vacation. Initially, the friends told Shanquella's mother that she had died of alcohol poisoning, that she had had too much to drink in Mexico. Okay, alcohol poisoning on vacation does happen to young people. However, the family was very skeptical and it did not sound right. But of course, the family's in shock because they just found out their daughter is dead. So, you know, it's kind of hard, Mike, to focus on what you do and you're far away and it's another country, another jurisdiction, another language. Oh, the worst possible circumstances, right?
Yeah, I mean, these are really tough cases because you're leaning on consulates, you're leaning on local law enforcement to reach out and try to be an intermediary. Local law enforcement in Mexico is dealing with something that for them is a challenge. Maybe it's a resource challenge, but all of a sudden now it's something that's becoming an international challenge. And so that introduces new playbooks for law enforcement. Plus the investigators, the people who really know what's going on, they don't have time to be doing all that. So it depends on what's the support staff looking like in those areas and what's coming back. And frankly, in all these cases, those first couple of days, there's so much stuff that's coming in and things are changing so rapidly that you really can't provide answers other than the individual's deceased and we're looking at it. That one, though, was really interesting. It boiled down to an autopsy, didn't it?
It did, an autopsy and then a video that came out later. And those two combined are very strong evidence. Mexican authorities determined through an autopsy that she died of severe spinal cord injury, a broken neck that was the result, the coroner said, of an attack. The coroner was very clear here, not an accident. So police suspect that she was attacked by one of the friends. I don't even want to use this word, friends. What kind of friends are these? Especially when you look at the video. What kind of friends are these on this trip? Now, we are going to show the video. It's going to be as blurred out as possible. I know some organizations have chosen not to show this video, but I think this video is incredibly, incredibly important to this case because it absolutely gives you a picture of what was going on. Was this the cause? I don't know. That will be up to the FBI and other investigators who know. But it is clearly, as a parent, as a human being, was a horrible thing to watch. And the fact that they even videotaped this, it was like a freaking scene out of the movie Fight Club.
You know what that is? That is what is really disturbing and frankly makes you wonder if other people shouldn't have some obligation criminally in the course of this thing. Why didn't they stop what was going on? And I think this is going to be where we really, again, have to look at the behaviors and those precipitating events that led up to that fight. Why on earth did that fight happen? Was there something going on relationship-wise that caused this person to just become inflamed? But again, why are all these people in the room if that's the case?
Yeah, we're going to show a clip of it. And y'all who are listening, so they're in this nice vacation rental. You can see the ocean outside the floor-to-ceiling windows or sliding glass doors. It's beautiful. There are several people in the room. There's someone who's actually recording this, apparently on their cell phone. It sounds like a man, you know, can't be clear of anything, but that's what it sounds like. And you see what we believe is another woman repeatedly pummeling Shanquella over the head and just beating with that person's fists, the attacker, and the other people, including the person, you know, taking the videotape, saying, "Shanquella, fight back." What? Why don't you just step in and help someone fight back? Give me a break.
Okay. Quilla, can you at least fight back?
No.
At least something. At least fight back, something.
Get up, bro.
This is really so disturbing when you think about it from that perspective, because you look at anything else. I mean, a fight breaks out on the football field. Players are pushing people away and doing things. That's the most testosterone-filled thing. But when you introduce anger into something, then things change.
I don't know. And I hope that that wasn't their version of some sick game that they were playing, right? I hope that that's not what... I have no idea what it was. So a little bit of background. The group arrives on October 28th. That morning is the last time that Shanquella talked to her mother. The mother said that she was happy, happy to be on vacation. Of course, she's in Cabo. Everything's great. She's on vacation with her friends. They're in a gorgeous place with a beautiful view. The following day on the 29th, Shanquella was found dead in the living room of that rental. Now, it's unclear what happened and the timeline because there are several versions out there. And so until we are notified by the authorities as to the final timeline, what we're going to do is we're going to give you the various reports of what's been suggested happened, because some of these reports were in Spanish language media out of Mexico. Some were here in the United States. And I don't know why there's a discrepancy, but there is. So according to the Mexican media, one of the friends called the authorities for help at around 2:15 in the afternoon, telling medics that Shanquella had quote, drunk a lot of alcohol and so needed help. Medics arrived, reported, and said that Shanquella, now this is one of the reports, claiming that Shanquella was stable but dehydrated and suggested that she should be taken to the hospital. Her friends told to take her to the hospital, but they did not. And that, I believe, makes them liable again in this situation. Yeah. Failing to act for a second time. If you fail to act the first time, if this video is truly authentic and the authorities can authenticate it and the individuals there and where it happened and the time it happened, and if those injuries are concretely linked to her death, they failed to act and to protect her. And then they got a second chance when they called for help. and yet fail to act again.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's going to be really interesting to see how that unfolds. And if the actual autopsy is able to determine how long that body was from the time law enforcement got that body to the ME back to when they say this happened. Because, again, these timelines are pretty fuzzy here, and the locations where her body's found versus where maybe the assaults occurred are kind of interesting too. As you unfold these other scenarios, I think we'll learn more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, one thing that, and is part of that version of events, Spanish language media said that Shankwella was dead by 6 p.m. Now, there's another version of these events, and it goes kind of like this. Again, we're basing all of this on what the families have said and on media reports. So the autopsy report claims that medics arrived at the villa at 3 p.m. and that she was already dead. They say that she had not been dead long. So, and then they all leave. Then they all leave. They get on a plane and they go home and they just leave her there. And yeah, somebody, right, was designated to call the mother and tell the mother, oh, your daughter's dead. Oh, but she was drinking. They omit to tell the mom that there's a videotape out there that suggests that they beat her.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So now, this disturbing video again, this appears to show Shankwella naked, disoriented, because really what you can tell in this video is she is not fighting back, but she's also not appearing to defend herself, if that makes any sense. So it is possible that she's either already disoriented from the beating, or she may have been drinking, or who knows what. Who knows what was done to her.
But clearly compromised. I mean, do you continue beating someone that is just a fish laying there limp?
No.
That's the thing that really troubles me, is the beating continued. And people like your description was perfect. A fight club are around yelling, you know, fight back, do something, because we're still wanting to be entertained here. This was disturbing that people could stand and watch this human being be beaten to death and film it and say, keep fighting. You know, we're not done watching yet.
Oh, it's so disturbing. So 3 weeks later, on November 17th, the state attorney general in Mexico launched an investigation into Shankwella's murder. The following day, on November 18th, the FBI opened their own investigation. And I guess when you have a foreign national who dies abroad under suspicious circumstances, Mike, then U.S. authorities are permitted to not only investigate, but then the prosecution of that death, even though it happened in Mexico, could even happen in the United States? Is that possible?
Well, yeah, and I'm wondering, too, if Mexico wanting to extradite has also changed kind of the playing field, where the FBI has to investigate in order to support whether the U.S. would extradite someone back to face something like that, knowing that they're now back safely in the United States. Again, yes, I mean, the Bureau is going to have responsibility in those foreign countries to look at patriots who are in trouble there.
So now the crime is being investigated jointly, not only by the Mexican authorities, but now U.S. authorities. While all of this is going on, the Robinson family has to lay their daughter to rest. So they have a funeral in the middle of all of this. So now, according to the latest reports from November 23rd, the state attorney general's office in Baja California issued an arrest warrant for an unnamed American citizen who was traveling with the group. The prosecutor says, again, Shankwella didn't die of an accident. It wasn't like, oh, we got into a fight. The prosecutor says it was an attack. So now we have this arrest warrant out there. We don't know who it is. They haven't revealed. We don't even know if the person's in custody yet. Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, I spent some time. I wasn't familiar with femicide.
Yes.
And the charge. I hope we're going to talk a little bit about that because I need a little bit of insight. I know what I've read online and what I tried to find through the Mexican consulate and through some of their local law. But, you know, it almost feels like a hate crime.
Yes, it's very interesting. So the charge is femicide. So that is specifically a homicide of a female. And Mexican law has you look at issues whether gender, investigators must determine whether gender and or domestic violence played a role in that female's death, because those are additional charges and additional protections that you have in Mexico. It's actually quite fascinating that would be a very specific charge that we do not have here. We do not have a homicide based on a gender, but this is their way of requiring the authorities to investigate whether it was hate based on gender and domestic violence, which I have to say, I kind of like that.
Yeah, it's really, really a great kind of a catch here to be able to do that. I mean, hate crimes in America really spawned a different way of investigating things, which again explored more the behaviors and the motivations for why the crime occurred. And I'm going to be really interested to find out, these people that were in the room, were they Mexican national or were they U.S. citizens that were in the room filming alongside them? Do we know any of that, Anna?
It is reported by the mother, Shankwella's mother, that she was traveling with all these friends, presumably from the U.S., but we do not know definitively who was in that room at the time of this beating and that videotape. We just don't know until the authorities release names and everything else and who traveled from where. We don't know. But on this one, I'm believing the mother. You know where your daughter is. You know who she travels with. You know who she's on vacation with. And she spoke to her daughter that morning. So I'm gonna say that the most accurate here is going to be the mom and the dad. And in fact, after the arrest warrant was issued, and again, we don't know if this person's been apprehended, Salamandra Robinson, who is Shankwella's mother, made a statement to news outlets saying, quote, "That's what we have been waiting for someone to finally be held accountable and arrested. I just can't wait for justice to be served."
So I don't know how anyone is not going to watch that video and be able to identify who was the aggressor and who was responsible.
Correct.
The reasons for what was going on, I think, are going to be huge. Can you imagine the challenge the Mexican government's going to have, though, trying to get witnesses to come back to Mexico to testify in this case if they're U.S. citizens?
Exactly. So my hope is that that case will be tried here in the United States, because we've seen that. We even saw, you know, there was that huge case recently with the very wealthy people from, I believe, the Pennsylvania area. He was either a doctor or a dentist, and a wife gets killed on safari. But the murder trial was here in the United States. It was not where they were on safari. So my hope is for this case, for Shankwella and her family, that the trial will be in the United States, not in Mexico.
So if she's convicted, the sentence, if I read everything correctly, was 45 to 75 years in Mexico. Is the U.S. compelled to follow that kind of a sentencing guideline, or has it become a U.S. sentence and she serves here, or does she go to Mexico if she's convicted?
I have a feeling, I don't know, and this, you know, the authorities will tell us this, but it's my understanding, just based on other cases where an American national has been killed abroad and the trial is actually held here, that everything will be based on U.S. law and the sentencing will be imposed and prison terms will be served here, unless the authorities decide that, no, this has got to be tried in Mexico. Remember, the arrest warrant has been issued by Mexico, not by the U.S.
Yeah. And these are the all the parties, at least at the point where we know now, are U.S. citizens. So there's not a compelling reason to say a Mexican national was murdered by this individual. We want him here serving time.
I think it's going to be, you know, I believe it'll end up being a U.S.-based case. But we'll see.
Interesting.
And we will we'll watch this one carefully. So we're not going to do comments today because we want to talk about why Mike is in Australia right now doing this podcast. And we're so grateful for you to step in at the last minute with all the time differences. So Mike, what are you doing there?
Well, so I'm actually down here meeting with law enforcement. I have meetings set up with federal and state and local law enforcement here. I've got about 30 meetings over the next 2 weeks while I'm here in Oz, and I'll be talking about analytic functions, investigative strategies, other kinds of things with law enforcement as I'm moving around, including some discussions with the military on how they're using analytics in the course of their duties. But in addition to that, I'm also here to pick up a little award that we won for a podcast that we've done down in Southeast Asia. It's called Mapping Evil with Mike King, and it's in its second season. And for some goofy reason, Anna, it resonated, and we won an Australian award for podcasting last year. This year, we were able to win an international award, and so I'm going to get a picture taken with a plaque, but I'm also going to be meeting with a 78-year-old man who, when he was a boy, witnessed his father committing a homicide. He carried it for his entire life. It's season two is called Killing Betty. It's the coldest cold case in Queensland. And we are going to walk around the neighborhood where Betty Shanks was murdered. And we're going to talk about what happened on that night and his experiences with his father. So it'll be a little bit of an interesting kind of full circle thing from 4 years ago when I met him. And the way I met him was so crazy because I was kind of ambushed by ABC television, which is Australian Broadcasting. In the middle of another interview, they asked me about Betty Shanks. I'd never heard of Betty Shanks in my life 4 years ago. And they said, how would you solve this cold case? And I said, well, the benefit of these kinds of cases is that over time, people get the courage to step up and talk about things that they may have witnessed decades earlier. And of course, I was just filling some airtime and doing a little soundbite. I got on a plane. When I landed in Los Angeles, my phone was ringing and I picked it up and it was this 78-year-old man who said, I watched your news broadcast. My father killed Betty Shanks.
And my goodness. Is that just unbelievable? That's incredible. When is this podcast, this next one?
So it's available now. You can just go on. You can binge watch it. It's only 4 episodes. We talk about some of the theories, including theories that point to other people, and explore them all. And we leave the end for you to decide who killed Betty Shanks. There's a lot of emotion up in Queensland about who was responsible. But I just love being here in Australia. It's, I think, my 8th or 9th trip to Australia, and I just love the people. And it's just going to be a lot of fun today.
Wow. Well, Mike, thank you for sharing all of that. And we will link to whatever we can here. And so where can people find you or follow you? I know we sometimes just communicate on Twitter.
That's right. Just at Profiling Evil will get you everywhere you need to go on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Of course, profilingevil.com is a great landing page.
Oh, amazing. And Mike, thanks again for stepping in at the last minute.
Thank you. Not only for the years of friendship, but for the work that you do. I just love listening to your show. And I love the fact that you explore these things. Your guests and your co-hosts are amazing. And I just feel honored to be able to step in and fill in for a short time.
Well, we're grateful for you. So be safe. Enjoy your adventures in Australia. You can find me at Anna G News, and nothing too exciting going on in my life.
But that's where you can find me. You can find, obviously, this episode, all episodes of our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and also sign up to receive our newsletters. I always find that so funny that we have a newsletter. We are so 1990s here sometimes. Our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com. Until next week, I'm your host, Anna Garcia. And as we always say, don't do crime.